Today on Against the Grain, what might Hindu and Tantric principles offer to movements for social change? Farah Godridge finds, in especially the Tantra tradition, resources for challenging gender, class, and other hierarchies. I'm CS. The UC Riverside professor discusses philosophy, politics, gender and caste relations in India, and much more coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Classical Hindu philosophical systems have been around for a long time. So has Tantric philosophy, which was taken up and adapted by feminist, New Age, and other movements in the West. According to Farah Godridge, Orthodox Hindu thought features a dualism that tends to denigrate the material world while elevating the realm of spirit. So what does the desire to transcend worldly affairs, what does that do to encourage or discourage worldly action and political activism? Farah Godridge has written about that, and also about what she sees as the subversive political potential of Tantra, which crucially does not promote a dualism between the material, which Orthodox thought casts as feminine, and the masculine-associated spiritual. Farah Godridge is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside, and her article about the political implications of the Tantric tradition and of classical Hindu thought appeared in the journal New Political Science. When Farah joined me in studio, I asked what prompted her to write the article.
What I was trying to do was to really think through the relationship between Hinduism and any kind of political stance. In the US, we're used to thinking about the relationship between the predominant religion, which is Christianity, and politics, right? We have a sense for what sort of role Christian beliefs and practices play in mainstream American politics. And I really was trying to think through what the equivalent would be, really, if you were to think through the predominant faith in India, which is Hinduism, and what sorts of different political leanings or commitments or practices it might be allied with.
And what you're doing is you're looking at both Hinduism and the Tantra tradition, Tantric thought. And I wonder if we could dive into Orthodox Hinduism to begin. Three of the most prominent or prevalent Orthodox philosophical systems within Hinduism are, and could you say them because I want to make sure they're pronounced correctly?
Sure. They are Sankhya, Yoga, and Advaita Vedanta.
Sankhya. Let's start with Sankhya. I wonder what that strand of thought has to say. And let's start here because it's so critical to everything you write about. The question of matter and spirit. Matter and spirit, what does this first strand, as you present it in your piece, what stance does it take?
So Sankhya is the oldest of what are called the orthodox schools of Hindu philosophy, of classical Hindu philosophy. And Sankhya's sort of view on the nature of the universe, if you will, tends to then be adopted by the later schools, which includes yoga and several other schools, and then in a different guise later, Advaita Vedanta. But Sankhya's metaphysics, if you will, right, its theory of the universe and how the universe is constructed tells us that there's a kind of hierarchy, right? That the material world, right, the body, that which is composed of matter, is inferior to ultimate reality or divinity or spirit, however you want to call it. I mean, we're using English terms to characterize something that is from a different time and place, but that's the best way we can kind of get at. So there's a kind of dualism, right? It's a dualist system of thought in that there are these two categories and the one is clearly inferior to the other. And the other important thing to note is that the one is masculine and the other is feminine. Right.
Which one is which?
So matter is represented by the feminine, which is called prakriti, and spirit or ultimate reality or the divine or the transcendent is represented as masculine, also called purusha. Now, it's worth noting that to this day in India and in sort of commonplace everyday Hindi, the word for man is purusha. So this is a kind, it's a very classical, very traditional dichotomy in which the masculine represents transcendence and the feminine represents the material, the bodily, the physical. And of course, right, the material, the bodily, the physical, they're impure, they're polluting, they're false, they're illusory. They keep us from realizing our transcendence, our union with the divine. So the hierarchy is pretty clear.
So the goal of practice within the Sankhya tradition is to transcend the material, is to move toward the, quote, masculine spiritual reality.
Yes, quite right. And it's not just for Sankhya. It's also for the yoga school. And I mention this because the yoga school of thought then ends up becoming tremendously influential for what we today think of as the practice of yoga, right? Which, you know, most people think of as like a bunch of exercises. But actually, it's quite heavily rooted in this yogic school of philosophy, which itself, right, is influenced by the Sankhya school. So indeed, for both of these schools and for many other orthodox or classical schools in Hindu thought, the very goal of human life is the transcendent realization, right, of one's purity, of one's divinity, which means moving beyond our materiality, moving beyond our embodiedness, right, our physicality. And by the way, that includes the mental. So in Hindu systems of thought, both mind and body are included in matter, right? Because eventually everything that happens in the mind, just like everything that happens in the body, is transient. It's fleeting, right? It comes and goes. It is not eternal. It does not last. So, and that requires in turn a kind of controlled withdrawal of the senses, right? Going inward, withdrawing, not being attached to the outer physical, worldly, bodily trappings, but rather going inward and detaching from them.
And then the third orthodox philosophical system that you bring up in this piece within Hinduism, Advaita Vedanta, does it retain this dualism?
Yes and no. So it's a later, much, much later school of thought, by about at least 8 centuries or so. And it's sometimes thought to challenge the dualism. In other words, Advaita Vedanta is often characterized as the foremost non-dual school in Hindu philosophy. And it's non-dual in the following sense. Advaita Vedanta tells us that ultimate reality is no different from the individual self, that there's no actual division or separation between us, the physical, and us, the transcendent. They are one and the same. So you are divine. You are that. The self is the ultimate. But despite that, despite what seems like a non-dualism, there is actually a legacy of dualism that kind of creeps into Advaita Vedanta, because Advaita Vedanta continues to tell us that the material is false, it's illusory, it's polluting, it's suspect. And by the way, in a lot of the myths and stories in this tradition, this is very often symbolized or represented by a woman. So Adi Shankara, who was the founder, the founding sort of scholar, philosopher, monk of that tradition, is often described as being lured away by a woman or being sort of attracted by a woman. And that interaction often sort of symbolizes, right, the push and pull. We are both material and transcendent, but in the end, really, we've got to get beyond our material nature. So I would characterize it as non-dual in some sense, but also kind of retaining a legacy of its predecessors.
What have commentators, or maybe the majority of commentators, said about the degree to which this focus on transcendence affects attitudes towards social and political engagement in the real material world and improving the material world?
Well, traditionally, these classical schools, Orthodox Hinduism, is thought to be actually quite opposed to involvement in worldly matters, right? Because if you think about it, if the goal of an individual life is to go within, to transcend, to liberate oneself, right, from the trappings of worldly life, then why care about anything that's happening in the world? And indeed, many leading voices within the tradition and also sort of later commentators have said precisely this, which is that, you know, there's this famous dichotomy in Hinduism between the householder and the renunciate.
The renunciate being the monk, the ascetic?
Right. Mm-hmm. The renunciate being the monk, the ascetic, and the householder being the person who, you know, is involved in running a home and having children and a family and caring about the social world. And it's thought traditionally that the renunciate or the ascetic is the kind of revered figure in Hinduism. That's the person that one is supposed to become ultimately. And so in Hinduism, there's often a theory of four stages of life. There's the stage of the student, the stage of the householder, the stage of, you know, the person who's kind of giving up worldly life, and then finally the renunciate. So, you know, it's thought to be a kind of goal-oriented, right? That the final stage is the one toward which you end. But that, what does that mean? If one is an ascetic, if one is a renunciate, if one is focused entirely on transcending the world, then family, society, politics, even suffering, justice, injustice, ethics, how does any of that matter? And so there's a suggestion that classically Hinduism is thought to be amoral, antisocial, anti-women, anti-sexuality, anti-family, and so on and so forth. And that's just one interpretation, but it's certainly an interpretation that I think has some currency.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Farah Godridge joins us. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside. And we are talking about an article she wrote about the political potential, the progressive political potential of Hindu philosophy, and especially the tantric tradition that appeared in the journal New Political Science. So I think you've already begun to answer my question about kind of what this dualism, the dualism between the material, which is cast as the feminine, and the spiritual, which is cast as the masculine, what that dualism has done to gender hierarchies and gender relations in India over the years and centuries. Could you elaborate on that and also talk about caste hierarchies and the extent to which this dualism, as emphasized by the Orthodox Hindu tradition and philosophy, how that dualism might have fed caste hierarchies as well?
Sure. Well, if you think about it, in traditional societies, it's the feminine that is closer to nature, to the sphere of the domestic, to the body through reproduction and through continuing sort of biological ties. And so really this association of the feminine with the material has persisted. And that hierarchy where, you know, women are the ones who sort of take care of the domestic and the material and the sort of natural spheres, whereas men are the ones who are scholars and priests and sort of transcendent aspirers, that hierarchy has persisted, right? And that's not unique, by the way, to Hinduism or to India. And then the other social group, which is close to nature, to the body, to caring for the body and to the products of the body, are lower castes. So, you know, I'm not sure how much your listeners know about caste in India. It's an incredibly fraught topic. But one can say, and I think most people would agree, that caste persists as a way of organizing social life in many parts of India, not all of India, and certainly I think less so in urban parts of India today, but in much of India, caste persists. And the idea of caste simply is that certain people are born into certain social groups and that birth into a certain social group then demands certain social stratification and certain occupations. The caste hierarchy basically follows this hierarchy, the matter-spirit hierarchy that we've seen in the Orthodox traditions. Just as the feminine is closer to nature and to the body and to working with one's hands and doing labor and so forth, so too are lower castes, right? If one is born into lower castes, those are the castes which clean up after people. Those are the castes which deal with the products of our bodily lives. Whereas higher castes, particularly, you know, the Brahmin or the priestly class, those are the castes in which people are pursuing thought and transcendence.
Okay, obviously there's much more to be said about the Orthodox Hindu tradition, its many strands, but I want to move at this point to Tantra. You call this a dissenting school that emerged in the early medieval era. First, is Tantra philosophy a monolith? Is it a single, consistent set of principles and ideas?
Absolutely not. Like everything else in the sort of rich tradition of Hinduism, Tantra is represented by a variety of texts and ideas and practices and traditions. In fact, the very word Tantra is a retrospective classification. It's really only probably a century or so ago that scholars decided to apply a single term to what was until then a kind of loosely affiliated set of texts and practices. And like so many other terms in the Sanskrit lexicon, the term Tantra has been used in so many different ways to mean so many different things. And, you know, the other famous Sanskrit term that has that baggage, of course, is the word yoga, which can mean so many things to so many people. But so no, Tantra is not a monolith. But I would say that there are probably certain core concepts, ideas, and practices that we can loosely say characterize these texts and ideas.
And if we kind of look at the common strands within Tantra, where do these strands, or where does the core of Tantra stand on this issue of denigrating, for example, in the Orthodox Hindu strands you spoke of, denigrating the feminine material world and elevating the spiritual world, which, you know, is characterized, which is cast as masculine?
Well, Tantra is radically non-dualist. So in contrast to, you know, when we talked about Advaita Vedanta, we said that it was non-dual in some sense, but that there was a kind of dualism that had crept in. Tantra, in contrast to its predecessors, asserts that the physical world and the transcendent or the ultimate reality are, not only are they not separate from each other, they are all made of a single intelligent energy. And that everything one experiences in the physical world, everything one experiences in the material world, is itself a manifestation of the divine. Now, to some extent, Advaita Vedanta held that too, but what distinguishes Tantra from its predecessors is that Tantra holds that the body is sacred. The body is itself a kind of receptacle of divinity. So whereas its predecessor traditions were constantly trying to deny or suppress or transcend or ignore the body in any number of ways, for the tantric practitioner, the body is the vehicle through which you attain liberation. You don't deny it. You don't suppress it. You don't try to make the urges go away. So desire, right, is a very key component of all of this. For the predecessor classical dualist schools of thought, desire is a real problem, because desire is the very thing that symbolizes our gross materiality, right? Our sort of craven humanness, if you will. And that's the problem that everyone's trying to get past. But for the tantric practitioners, our desire is itself divine. Yes, it makes us human, but it's also the thing that can lead us toward divinity. So let's harness it, the tantric texts tell us. Let's harness its power and let's actually use embodied experiences like food, music, art, and of course, most famously, sex, right? Let's use these embodied experiences as doorways, if you will, to realizing our ultimate union with divinity.
Farah Godridge is her name. She teaches political science at UC Riverside. She's author of Cosmopolitan Political Thought, Method, Practice, and Discipline. And we are talking about an article she wrote. It's entitled Orthodoxy and Dissent in Hinduism's Meditative Traditions, A Critical Tantric Politics with a question mark. It appeared in the journal New Political Science. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Where do tantric texts locate the feminine and the masculine?
For tantric texts and practices and practitioners, unlike for its predecessors, for whom, and this will be familiar actually to Western beliefs and religions, you know, in Western and also in classical Hindu beliefs, the feminine is the receptive, passive force, whereas the masculine is dynamic and active and creative. Tantra inverts that. In tantric metaphysics, in the tantric view of the universe, the feminine principle is the causal principle behind everything in the universe. In other words, the feminine makes everything happen. It's the dynamic life force behind everything that's happening. It is the creative force of the universe. The masculine principle in Tantra is the force of stillness and awareness and stability. So very often in the tantric traditions, there are different forms of meditation, but the forms of meditation in which one learns to quiet the mind and sort of be the awareness behind all of the chaos of the mind, that is often said to approximate masculine stillness. Whereas the forms of meditation in which one contemplates the sort of dynamism and movement of the universe, those are said to represent the feminine. And crucially, in the tantric set of texts and beliefs and practices, there's no hierarchy. It's the union between these two that symbolizes that ultimate non-dual presence, which is within everything and everyone.
Well, talk about the goddess figure, and I think it's goddess figures, right, in tantric thought, in tantra. So you have this feminine energy, this dynamic energy. It's personified, as you write, in the goddess Shakti. What forms does Shakti take?
Shakti takes a variety of different forms. She can take a kind of militant, destructive, terrifying form as one of the warrior goddesses. The most well-known ones are Durga and her alter ego Kali. These goddesses are also quite unapologetically sexual. Or she can take a kind of sweeter, more wifely, domestic form like Lakshmi or Parvati. So she can take a variety of different forms, but in all of these forms, she is the feminine as the creative power.
So if in Tantra there is no kind of dualism between the material and the spiritual, what stance would Tantra take toward the parts of the material world, the aspects of material existence that one might find especially disturbing or disgusting, you know, talking about perhaps in the parlance of Orthodox Hindu tradition, some of the most polluting aspects of the material life, of material existence?
Yeah, this is a great question. So it depends a little bit on whether one is talking about left-handed or right-handed tantra. There are sort of two paths, I think, broadly speaking, within tantric practice. The right-handed path is considered the more conventional, the more in keeping with sort of traditional mores, if you will. But the left-handed path, I think, is really the one that is more antinomian, kind of anti-establishmentarian, unconventional, transgressive, really. And it's in that path that I think we see most clearly Tantra's stance toward the body. And I think in that path, we find that it's not simply that one embraces the body and that one sort of harnesses the energy of the body. It goes even further. It's that one must learn to experience divinity within everything. And that includes some of the most horrifying and polluting aspects of reality. For instance, in Orthodox Hinduism, you know, there are rituals of purity and pollution. And very often these rituals involve abstaining from things like meat and alcohol and sexual intercourse and so forth that are considered, you know, polluting because of their sort of association with base bodily, you know, desires. Whereas Tantra says, let us experience the profane. Let us truly experience the profane, the shocking, the polluting in order to see that the divine is within everything. And then to transcend. So very often one hears ancient stories of tantric practitioners practicing in cremation grounds and graveyards or drinking out of skulls. I don't know how true these are, but I think they're more symbolic. Their importance is symbolic. They symbolize the tantric practitioner's belief that through violating these conventional norms, through violating that distinction between the pure and the impure, the sacred and the profane, that's how you experience true power, true transcendence.
Farah Godridge is her name. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Riverside. We are talking about an article I found in the journal New Political Science that she wrote about the political potential of the tantric tradition and its ideas, and the Hindu tradition. And we'll speak more with Farah, especially about the political implications of what she's been telling us about these philosophies. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song, a political scientist named Farah Godridge, who is based at UC Riverside, joins me in studio. And she is the author of a book called Cosmopolitan Political Thought. Her areas of research and teaching include Indian political thought, Gandhi's political thought, cosmopolitanism, globalization, comparative political theory, and environmental political thought. And we are talking about an article she wrote about Hinduism and Tantra and the political potential that might be found within either of those traditions. And we're talking about a variety of strands, of course, of different ways of thinking and different schools of thought within these traditions, Hinduism and Tantra. So the acceptance and in some sense the embrace of the material world by Tantra, by tantric texts, that suggests to me that maybe, okay, involvement in worldly affairs might not be so taboo and might not be so negative in the eyes or in the view of this tradition as it was with some of the orthodox Hindu strands you were talking about, where the material world is considered really almost beneath our concern. We should focus on transcendence. We should focus on moving toward the spiritual. So is that one political implication one might take, that involvement in the material world, in what's happening in our everyday existence, might be more the Tantra practitioners or people who are inspired by tantric ideas might be more ready to be involved in these kinds of things?
I think it can go one of two ways. On the one hand, if one is embracing everything as an expression of the divine, as a manifestation of Shakti or divine energy, it's possible that one could arrive at a kind of apolitical indifference to suffering or injustice. I mean, after all, it's all Shakti. And I've heard practitioners say something to that effect. Oh, it's all Shakti. It's all the work of the Shakti. Shakti will do as she must. And that can lead to a kind of apathy. That can lead to a kind of indifference. So who am I to get in the way of what Shakti is doing? My goal is to embrace it, to embrace the horror as well as the divinity. But I think it's a little dangerous, because I think that can also lead to a kind of caricature of Tantra. And this is actually something that has been the case, I think, in sort of colonial Orientalist caricatures of Tantra. And this is partly why Tantra, I think, has been driven underground in India, which is that during the colonial period, it was seen as this kind of, degenerate, amoral, transgressive way of life, and really vilified as such. So I think it's dangerous to think that that's the only way tantric beliefs can lead. I think it's also possible that one celebrates the material world as a manifestation of Shakti's life-giving power, and therefore one is inspired to protect it and make it free of suffering. Because if Shakti has given us this incredible universe, then perhaps it's our duty to make it as beautiful as we can, to make it as divine as we can. So I think it can go both ways. I think it contains a kind of potential for extreme attention to the suffering of others, but also a potential for indifference. And I think it would depend on the practitioner.
And what about on the issue of gender and on the status of women and on how women are viewed? The, in a sense, celebration of the feminine by Tantra, would that necessarily suggest to you that women would be treated better, would be treated in a more humane way, viewed in a more humane way?
I think the short answer is yes, but it's not without complication. I think it's true that if one is being strictly tantric about one's approach to gender, then yes, the feminine is worshipped as symbolic of divinity. Definitely, there is not the kind of hierarchy that one sees in Orthodox Hinduism. The feminine is not only not construed as impure, but is actually sort of seen as the force that makes everything happen. And accordingly, one would imagine that women would hold a kind of a place that's free of, hierarchy and oppression and so forth. But I think that that is actually complicated by the fact that there's actually a kind of gender essentialism in tantric belief as well, because putting women on a pedestal and worshipping them for their biological capabilities, that's a really old story in some ways. It's an old story of how patriarchy continues to persist, right? So I think it's a little tricky. I think it's tricky and complex, and I don't think that one can simply say that a tantric set of commitments automatically leads to a healthy relationship between the genders. But I certainly think that tantric commitments invert and resist the hierarchies that classical Hinduism gave us. And they certainly free their practitioners from all the anxiety around the body that Hinduism is so weighted down by.
And that freedom from anxiety and freedom from, in some sense, repressiveness was very popular with the West, with people in the West who took up tantric ideas or what they thought were tantric ideas. And I'm speaking here about the latter part of the 20th century with the liberation movements, the New Age crowd, feminist movements. What do you make of that adoption of or appropriation of tantric philosophy in the West?
Well, I think it's trivializing and distorting That's what I make of it. I mean, I'm sure others may have different perspectives on it, but, you know, it's what some scholars have called pop tantra, right? It's the sort of the new age and the kind of countercultural liberation movements of the late 20th century saw tantra's embrace of the body as something to undergird their own pursuit, right, of sex positivity and self-help and all of the other stuff that came with the New Age, none of which, by the way, I have any objection to. It's simply that, you know, a tradition like Tantra, which is so rich, was taken and I think kind of reduced to one element, which was its sexual practice. And to this day, if you say Tantra or Tantric to any Westerner, there's literally one thing that they think of, and that's sex. They'll say, oh yeah, I know about Tantric sex. Right, but Tantra is actually about much, much more than that. But somehow in its appropriation, in its employment in the New Age movement, it's gotten kind of reduced. It's gotten reduced to a kind of cult of ecstasy. And that, I think, is unfortunate.
I'm joined by Farah Godrej, and her last name is spelled G-O-D-R-E-J. Her first name is F-A-R-A-H, and she is a political scientist at UC Riverside. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. There's so much more to ask you about, but I'm interested in whether, as you think about the political potential of specifically Tantra, whether you are more focused on its possible application in India with its caste and gender hierarchies and other hierarchies, or the U.S. with its own inequalities and hierarchies.
I have focused more on Tantra's emancipatory potential in India. I think the life of Tantra in the West has gone in a very different direction, as we just spoke about. It's actually much more interesting to me, having myself grown up in India as a woman and having experienced what gender dynamics in India are like, to think a little bit about what Tantra's emancipatory potential might be, with, of course, all the cautions that I already mentioned. The really interesting thing about Tantra in India is that I never heard about it growing up in India. It is only much later, having come to the West and become an academic and started reading and studying the South Asian tradition, that I began to learn about it. If one hears of Tantra in India, it is in a very, very marginal way. Oh, Tantra is what those weird voodoo black magic people do. That's the stereotype of Tantra in India. And I think the reason for that is that Tantra was largely driven underground. And it was driven underground. I mean, you can imagine, right? It's this heterodox dissenting tradition that is basically taking all the caste and gender hierarchies of the predominant tradition and trying to subvert them. And I think that the British colonial regime was an important story in all of this because, first of all, Hinduism as a whole had to be painted in a certain way by the British in order to justify why it is that we need to civilize these people, the civilizing mission, right? So already Hinduism was treated in a certain way by sort of the Orientalist discourse of the colonial powers. On top of that, within Hinduism was this other dissenting strand, right, where women are being worshipped and the goddesses are these crazy sexual figures. I mean, you can just imagine what the British made of that. And so Tantra was sort of resoundingly vilified, not just by the British, but then by Indian elites who had kind of internalized British Orientalist logic and who wanted to kind of sanitize and civilize Hinduism so that it could be accorded a degree of respectability, right? So it was really respectability politics, if you will, that drove Tantra, I think, underground, both by Indian elites and from sort of critiques by the British. And the way that that happened, I think, is that Tantra was domesticated. And what I mean by domesticated is simply that these fierce goddesses, with all of their unapologetic sexuality and their warrior-like characters, started to be painted as sweet and docile and loving and deferential. So I think it's worth thinking about what it would mean for India and predominant Hindu culture within India, because of course the two things are very different. Hinduism is only one among many faiths in India. What it would mean for the predominant faith of India to recover or rediscover this other dissenting strand. I think there's a tremendous potential there, and I think it's probably tremendously threatening as well, but it's there.
And I could see it being threatening, especially to the right wing in India, the Hindu right wing. What have they done in terms of appealing to classical Hindu ideas? And how difficult would it be for subversion of the kind that you're suggesting to happen in that atmosphere of the ascendance of the right wing in India?
It's very difficult in India to speak about the convergence of Hinduism with politics without having that conversation completely and utterly co-opted by the right wing, unfortunately. And this is because all revivals of classical Hindu thought within contemporary thinking, and especially within politics, have occurred, I think, solely through the lens and the voice of the nationalist Hindu right wing. So that, in the words of one scholar, I'm paraphrasing now, it's actually almost impossible to think of any Hindu religious text or practice intervening in politics without it having a kind of right-wing Hindu dimension. And that is very, very unfortunate. So it's difficult to talk about all this without making some sweeping generalizations, which I'm always a little wary of, but being mindful that we are having a limited conversation, I would say then that in contemporary India, the Hindu right-wing platform has really relied upon a kind of high-caste resentment regarding the socioeconomic mobility of lower castes, and also the invocation of a kind of retrograde conception of gender and sexuality in which the woman is cast as pure, unpolluted, and expressions of sexuality are particularly frowned upon as foreign to Hindu culture. And given everything we've said, that's actually just inaccurate. But it is the party line. It is the party line discourse. And by the way, it's not just the Hindu right wing, which has leaned on the kind of orthodox hierarchies and sort of wants to make sexuality disappear altogether. I would say that Gandhi, who was otherwise very politically progressive, certainly in his insistence on breaking down caste hierarchies, in his insistence on Hindu-Muslim unity, Gandhi himself was highly masculinist and highly dualist in his views on sexuality. And I think Gandhi would be mortified by the version of Tantra that I'm giving you. So a kind of puritanical morality in which both men and women, but particularly women, are construed as asexual, as devoid of sexual desire, and as therefore pure and kind of standing in for the Hindu nation, if you will. This is all very commonplace in sort of contemporary Hindu political discourse. And I think that Tantra, given everything we've said, can intervene greatly in that.
Gandhi comes off as a complicated figure in your article, and I really appreciate that. We're talking about an article by my guest Farah Godridge that appeared in the journal New Political Science last June, for those of you who want to look up the article. But of course, you know, we do have to say, and you did say, that he had a number of progressive views that, you write, he took from, for example, classic Hindu texts like the Bhagavad Gita. He found a way to, for example, synthesize the realms of renunciation and activism. So it wasn't just about renouncing all worldly activity. He obviously was in favor of social action, political action. Given that, do you see any, or I should say, what do you see as the political potential of classical Hindu philosophy? You've talked about the political implications of taking a tantric stance, but what about somehow using orthodox Hindu ideas to shake things up in India?
Well, the orthodox tradition is hardly speaks with one voice. There is the strand of the orthodox or the classical traditions that values renunciation and perhaps deprioritizes engagement with the socio-political world. But there is also another strand, actually multiple strands, of that tradition which reflect at length on matters of ethics, economic policy, jurisprudence, statecraft, and so on, which are all highly worldly matters pertaining to society and politics and so forth. And this, you know, this body of literature is quite large and quite complex. There's the theory of the purusharthas, which many of my colleagues have actually written about, in which you have four purposes or goals to life. This is different from the four stages that I discussed earlier. These are four goals or four purposes, and they are kama, which is desire, artha, which is wealth or power, dharma, which is ethics, and moksha, which is liberation. And the fact that kama and artha are two of the four most important goals, in other words, desire or pleasure, and wealth or power or prosperity, depending on how you translate it. The fact that those two are so important suggests that the Hindu tradition is not entirely devoid of emphasis on worldly questions. One of the most important demonstrations of this is within the Bhagavad Gita, we have an emphasis on a concept called karma yoga. And this is actually the concept that I think inspired Gandhi, this idea that we do have to give up our desires. We do have to focus on renouncing desire. But in so doing, we're renouncing our attachments and we are actually trying to undertake disciplined action according to what the welfare of all demands. So this concept of disciplined worldly action for the welfare of all, while renouncing one's own desire, that's how I translate karma yoga, comes to us from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the canonical text of classical Hinduism.
And so you are implying in some sense that there is an emancipatory political potential within orthodox classical Hinduism?
I think this is deeply dependent on interpretation. I think that if one interprets disciplined worldly action for the welfare of all to include people of all genders, then yes. But I think if one remains attached to a particular hierarchical conception of groups like caste and gender by birth, then I think that that emancipatory potential starts to look less powerful.
And as we wrap up, Farah, I mean, it's clear from this article that you feel like the subversive political potential of Tantra is greater than of classical Hindu philosophy. Which aspect of Tantra and its transgressive nature do you think would best help to subvert orthodoxies that currently dominate Indian society and culture?
I think the potential of Tantra is greatest to intervene in sort of the existing hierarchies of gender and caste in India. And I say this with some caution because I've already talked about how, you know, there's some problems in Tantra's approach to gender. And by the way, its approach to gender is also extremely heteronormative. So I don't see this as a kind of catch-all solution uncritically. But I do think that in a context, in a deeply patriarchal, hierarchical context where sexual desire has been read as the singular property of the male, where the female has been repeatedly and consistently prevented from having any permissible, expressible sexual desire and has been morally policed and punished repeatedly. I mean, we can cite Supreme Court rulings and all sorts of legal and political mechanisms to shut down sexuality in general, but particularly female sexuality, and to police the bodies of women. In that context, I think introducing Tantra's reverence for feminine sexuality as a powerful concept worthy of worship is deeply, deeply dissident and subversive. I don't think it's easy, but I fantasize about a way to see a kind of religious revival, if you will, a kind of neo-tantric revival, an indigenous revival. And by indigenous, I mean it really has to come from within India by indigenous practitioners, indigenous to India, I should say. That's kind of a loaded term. But I fantasize about Indian feminists and Indian queer activists and other marginalized peoples, low caste or formerly untouchable Dalit people in India, claiming and reclaiming Tantra as their own to resist the kind of patriarchal essentialism that casts female sexuality as a moral aberration. And so I can imagine a kind of revival of tantric feminism in contemporary India. This may be my own fantasy, but it's a transgressive, subversive, and I hope a hopeful one.
Farah Godridge is an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside. She's author again of Cosmopolitan Political Thought, Method, Practice, and Discipline. And we've been talking about an article she wrote. It's entitled Orthodoxy and Dissent in Hinduism's Meditative Traditions, A Critical Tantric Politics, with a question mark. It appeared in the journal New Political Science last June. Farah, delightful meeting you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, C.S. It's been a pleasure.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.